My next guest, though, is the first Māori woman to earn a doctorate from a New Zealand university with a PhD on the effects of tourism on the Te Arawa people. In 1996, she became the first Wahine Māori professor in the country. Ngahuia Te Awakotuku is releasing her memoir, Hine Toa, a story of bravery, which traces a restless working-class girl from the Pā who became a founding member of Ngā Tamatoa and the women's and gay liberation movements. It is being launched this morning, the Puka Puka, and Ngahuia is with us now. Kia ora, ata marie.
Ata marie ki a Chris Susie, a ngā mihi kauame ki ngā tangata e whakarongo mai nei, and thank you so much for inviting me to participate in your Saturday morning. I'm really, really honoured by that. Thank you.
Ngā mihi. Ngā mihi, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to have you with us this morning. And I think your Puka Puka is being launched at your marae, is that right?
Yes, it's being launched today at Te Papai Uru in Rotorua on the shores of the lake, where the St. Faith's Church is sitting, looking wonderful in the steam. And our house, Tamate Kapua, the really large, grand, majestic house of the Te Arawa people, is where we will actually do the ceremony. And I'm just so excited and apprehensive. The last time I was the focus of an event in that house was when I got my PhD awarded by the University of Waikato, and the elders requested that they do the ceremony there, and that was in 1981. So it's quite unsettling and strange to be here over 40 years later and suddenly the focus of something else. I'm deeply grateful to my elders now, my cousins, my uncles and aunts, to the community for today's event. Mm. Kia ora.
Mm. There's so much in the book, so much extraordinary, rich detail about your growing up, about whangai adoption, about your name and your whakapapa in the book, which I found really illuminating to read. Why was it so important to you to lay out that foundation and to give that level of detail?
Like so many Māori, and particularly Māori of mixed heritage, Susie, and people that have been relocated into another whānau, understanding who you are for us is really, really important. And of course, if we look at the ancestry.com industry, I think that obsession moves beyond Indigenous people to humanity generally, and particularly those of us who are living in what is euphemistically called settler societies. Mm. There's a real need to know about origins. For me, I looked so different from the people around me. One of the peculiar aspects of my being me, which I talk about in the book, is that I had, you know, such a peculiar voice that was so different from everybody else in the village and the community. And yet my two biological sisters have got the same voice. And we would speculate we may have heard it from our maternal grandfather when we were in utero, when we were in the womb. And this was the voice that somehow went into our ears as we were growing inside our mother, because it's nothing like other kids. And when I met my two sisters on the occasion of our mother's tangi. We all wept and cried and fell apart because we sounded like each other. And we'd been harassed and teased about our very weird voices. And, basically, slagged off for sounding like the Queen Mother. And yet that's how we talked. And we were three Māori girls. One grew up in Makitu Te Puke Taurana, and the other grew up in Rotuisi Tikitere, and I grew up here in Ohinamutu. So finding out who you are, I think, is a pathway that can give you a sense of understanding the world around you, and also, though, connecting to other people. And that's what makes it really exciting as well. I enjoy watching and being with others.
That really comes through in the book when you are writing about your experiences with some of the people who've really been inspirations to you across your life and as you were growing up. And it's very detailed, and one that really stuck out to me as well was the encounter you describe with your mother, with Arana. How would you describe that? Because it feels a little bit like you're being torn in two at one point.
Oh, I was. That was a truly searing and scalding moment. I'd been wondering about this person for so long. I looked like her. People would tell me that I was her mirror image. So I'd be at Māori community events looking for an older woman with my face. I'd wonder about trying to seek the reflection of me. And suddenly there she was in this grand American Chevrolet being driven by her sister, my aunt, whom actually I really do look like. And there she was. And then they drove away. And I was left standing on the side of the road, knowing that my blood was driving off in this wonderful car. And I had to basically trot back to the path. I mean, it was really hard, and yet, you know, in my describing that as trotting back to the path, I was running back to the arms of my exquisite, fabulous grandmother, my kuia, who I think is in many ways the very heart of the book.
Yes, she comes across very much as the heart of the book, right through it, and is absolutely a central figure, clearly for you as well as being a central figure in the book itself.
Yes.
I enjoyed reading about your school days. Largely enjoyed reading about your school days. There was an interesting part where you, I guess, almost see the future, where you encounter the first Māori woman to get a PhD.
Oh, yes, ngā pare. Ngā pare hopa. Ki te whakarongo mai koe ki ngā mihi kawana ki a koe, just in case she's listening. Ngā pare hopa was the most extraordinary inspirational presence just for a few hours in my life when I was about 12 or 13. She came to interview my kuia, Hera, who in her day and in her time was one of the greatest traditional weavers. And I say that humbly, but it's true, she was. She was a significant fibre artist. And Ngāpare was working on a project which turned into a book called The Art of Pew Pew Making. And she came to interview my grandmother, and her whole manner, and this Māori woman, absolutely Māori, with this long, long, long ringlet over one shoulder and this beautiful suit and these delicate hands. And she had a book, a little notebook, and a pen. And she sat there and she made notes of what my grandmother was saying in Māori and English. And I was completely entranced by this, that someone would sit and record and then turn what my kuia was talking about later into a book. And we didn't have that many books in our home. We had Te Paipiera Tapu, the Holy Bible, and an absolutely well-thumbed first edition of Sir Peter Buck's Becoming the Māori. Anyway, watching a Māori woman, not much older than me, like maybe 10, 12 years older than me, sitting there writing notes, and she was also going to university. That was completely extraordinary. Like, she was a dream I carried in my head all through high school. Ngā Pare was the first encounter I had with a Māori woman of education and mana and confidence and beauty. All that. And it told me that if I tried hard enough, maybe I could be with those two. And that was great, because as a weaver surrounded by art makers of absolutely peerless excellence, I was just hopeless. I was, oh God, I got in the way. I couldn't do flax. I couldn't do fibre. I couldn't do anything. And this is after sitting in the paharekeke, in the weaving environment, with my aunts, with my mother, with my grandmother, with my great aunts. I got in the way, so I made the cups of tea and I cleaned up. But here, with Ngā Pare, there was something I knew I could do. I could do that. I could do that well. And by then, I'd already won a prize for writing. So I knew I could write. I could make words. And I could weave great korowai of words. And it made real sense to me. It gave me a way forward. Whereas getting tangled up in skeins of flax fibre, no, not my future.
You encounter at school and also at university some what feels like pretty shocking levels of racism, and also, I suppose, of erasure. You go to the Gold Coast as a teenager. And you're curious about Aboriginal people, but don't see any. How do you look back on that time?
Oh, God. It was a time when the government policy and the economic environment of that day was condescending, structured to pay Māori well and house us adequately as long as we didn't step above our station, so that most of us were quite happy to be in the trades or to be in the service jobs or to be contented with what was sent our way. I talk a lot about class as well. I write a lot about what I consider to be the extreme injustices of certain families with particular surnames being privileged and sent off to private schools and then on to university, whereas others with equal talent, if not greater talent and intellectual capacity, ended up being shoved into the commercial stream at school and trained to be typists. I mean, stuff like that was really getting to me even when I was 14 or 15. For me, because of my hunger as a kind of insatiable kid that loved words and ideas and all of that stuff, which comes from my own whakapapa, my own genealogy, I found racism, it's hard to describe now, because now in 2024, after the last 60 years of analysis and confrontation and writing and critical theory and all of that stuff, we have got words for those things. In the 1950s and 60s, we didn't have the words. Mm. We had the feelings. We had the sense of outrage. We knew that something was kind of off. I may have referred at some point, well, I did, about the colour bar. Mm. But the colour bar happened to my grandparents in Vancouver in 1910.
Mm.
In 1910, when they were travelling with a concert party to London with Maggie Papakura's touring group. That was a colour bar. And yet, here in Aotearoa, there were certain practices as well that were certainly questioned, but were also just kind of quietly gone along with. And that's why I think I really celebrate being around when I was, to start kicking those things down and stomping on them and pushing them over. And particularly in the high school context, we saw that, we experienced that as young Māori women. However, I must digress just briefly and say that we talked about racism and we talked about apartheid and we talked about the horrors of what was happening in Africa and other parts of the world when I was a little girl, what would now be called year 6, 7, 8 at St. Michael's Convent School here in Rotorua with the most extraordinary, courageous, visionary Irish Sisters of Mercy. We were so lucky. We had good nuns. And then, of course, no secondary Catholic school. So I ended up in the state system. And it prepared me for a life of radicalism.
Well,
that's a funny way to put it.
Radicalism indeed. You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National. My guest is Ngahui Te Awe Kotuku. We're talking about Hine Toa, A Story of Bravery, her memoir that is launched today. When you get to university, you're carrying on with the activism. There's an awful lot, I suppose, initially on women's liberation, but you talk about keeping Māori out of it, certainly initially. Why was that?
Because I'm a lesbian. I went where the girls were. I was young and hungry and curious. And at that time, most of the Māori students were from privileged backgrounds, professional or middle class parents, private school products. I mean, they weren't like me. I wasn't like them.
Mm.
So I hung with the creatives, with the anti-Vietnam crowd, with the druggies, with the Elam students. I found my niche more in people as committed to outrage and questioning and social justice for others as well as ourselves, than with a kind of small cosseted group of privileged Māori. Once the state school Māori students came into the university system, I think the Māori environment on campus began to transform. Mm. I'd like to say, though, that, yes, I went where the girls were.
Mm.
That was just the way I was. And even though, of course, along the way I got tangled up in all sorts of other shite, I followed the ladies. And as someone doing that, of course, I ended up deeply involved in the feminist and in the gay liberation environments. Mm. But my Māori self remained and nurtured and sustained me, but that was like over there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Before we talk a little bit more about that, you have an encounter with Jermaine Greer at
oh,
this
God.
Time.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because it's a great story.
Should I just do a teaser?
Oh, probably. Because you want people to buy the book, right?
I really do. I was part of, like, within women's liberation by 1972, there was very obviously and visibly two streams. And one stream was the rowdy lesbian activist snorting, bellowing, raging group, which consisted of young working class mothers and their husbands and their children and older women and people that were much more analytical and living the issues rather than sitting in a university environment or in the safe and privileged locations of their own homes in Epsom and St Heliers and Karori and Kandala, looking at the plight of women and deciding, yes, we will campaign for equal rights or blah de blah. There was quite a distinct difference. And also, too, as I said, I was a queer girl. I was a lesbian girl. I was an angry girl. And I was a rowdy, demanding, attention-seeking girl too. And at the same time, within the movement, we had a group of incredibly poised and well-mannered and articulate ladies who certainly captured media attention and were engaged in the invitation and hosting of Greer after the publication of her book, The Female Eunuch, to promote New Sunday newspaper. She arrived and she was not in any way available for the likes of us. So what we did, and by us I mean the rowdy lesbians and all the working class people from around Ponsonby and Greylin, and all the really radical Republican, hardcore feminist activists, and I've got to say their husbands and their men, because what was interesting, it was very mixed back then. We decided we'd have to actually make ourselves known to her, and so we organised a strike, or rather an action, as she arrived at Auckland Airport. And I was prancing around, screeching my head off. She saw me and she wanted to meet me.
Mm. Is this when you're dressed as a witch?
I didn't. Yes, as some kind of hag.
Mm.
And I didn't realise until she and I were in her motel room, which was Grafton Oaks on the corner of Park Road and Grafton. It was very new and very flash. That she liked women of colour. I didn't know that. Anyway, she liked me, and the encounter is described with some hilarity in Hene Toa. However, at that time, I was involved in an emotional and intimate relationship and a huge political activist connection with Katerina Nave, and she rescued me from Greer.
Mm.
And that's all I'll say.
Yes, it's definitely worth reading that one if you get the chance. Something else that happened at university that I would like to ask you about, because you do write about it in the book, but in almost an oblique sort of disassociating sort of a way, the experience of becoming a mother yourself, the experience of being hapū, feels like a very difficult one.
The name of that chapter is Betrayal, Susie, because I felt that my lesbian identity and my absolutely unacceptable female body had betrayed me. I was a lesbian woman. This shouldn't happen.
Hmm.
The fact I'd gone down the road and done it with a male didn't necessarily mean I had fallen into that position. It was probably the most excruciating few months of my life. I describe all the various attempts at terminating the pregnancy, as well as the body that the pregnancy was sitting in, growing in. It's a hard one to answer. I think I've said enough. But that was the time. And I do want people to understand this. In those days, you had nothing but the rhythm method or Durex. There was no contraceptive availability, apart, of course, from married women that would go to their doctors, have a special prescription for what was then an experimental drug. So the entire environment of sexuality, intimacy, heterosexual relations, whether they were accidental, incidental, or absolutely planned and committed and devoted, all of those types of being were controlled and obsessed by the risk of bringing another life into the world. And, it was hard. I was not going to include that section. And then I thought of all those other girls in the 1950s and 60s. And what they went through with ghastly places like Bethany and St. Mary's, and also the ridiculous notion that Māori looked after themselves. We did not, or that you've got a university baby. This is a university baby. And that whole trade and specialness of pregnant university students and their losing and relocating and then getting on with their careers or their professional development, if they were lucky enough to. I mean, this was also the time in the teachers' college system, if you were found out to be that way, or even the civil service, well, that was it, end of your life, end of your career. End of your life. I guess I sound really bitter on this one. That was a hard question, Susie. Thank you.
Well, thank you for writing about it, because I think it's, you know, it is part of your life, but also it is illuminating, as you say, your experience, but also the experience of so many others.
Yeah. It was, and for many, many years, I kept that as an absolutely private part of my life. Now that I'm 75, I'm speaking out. I'm sharing it. Apart from the fact, of course, that I have the most extraordinary granddaughter, to whom I had actually dedicated the book. So I'm delighted with that. She's a maths person. She's wonderful.
Yeah, I saw that in the acknowledgements that you dedicate the book to her, which is rather beautiful.
Thank you.
You do become an activist, beyond lesbian, beyond feminist campaigning, and move into Māori rights. And the lasting legacy of that, of Ngā Tamatoa, must be something that you're very energised by.
Oh, totally. And what's amazing is that we're still around. And, you know, there are personalities in Hine Toa whom I have described. There's one individual whose name I've changed slightly, who has gone on to do amazing things and become a PhD and changed all sorts of directions in the tertiary sector. We're still here. Well, people like my cousin Donna Awatere and what she achieved and bungled, and Linda Smith. I mean, her contribution to research and understanding the Aotearoa and indigenous environments are immeasurable. And there are lots of us. Larry Parr out there doing his thing in broadcasting and television. John Ohia, mathematician, glorious, amazing teacher and inspirer. And now on the Marae, he's an octogenarian and he's being a revered charismatic elder. Hilda and Hone Harawira, they were kids, they were teenagers. They were fresh out of St. Stephen's and Hillary College when they came in. And they've made such immense changes and contributed so much to the far north. And of course, although they've both gone now, I salute Hannah and Sid Jackson and what they achieved and how well they organised and regulated us. And then my other cousin, I go on hammering about Te Arawa women, but I think of Merata Mita and her vision and her focus and her extraordinary creative and often outrageous sensibility and what she choreographed with us in the protest sector and how, of course, that rolled into her filmmaking. You know, they were extraordinary human beings. They were part of us and we were part of them. I think of Michael Walker as well, the son of Ranginui Walker, and how he was one of our most important and groundbreaking marine biologists. And yet he was Ngā Tamatoa and alas has since become quite ill. But, you know, we're still here. We'll never go away. And what is important to say is that in this time, in this day, we need to really concentrate and refocus and commit ourselves again to the work that we began or continued 50 plus years ago, because we are living in a time of danger. We are living in a time of threat. We are living in a time of such insecurity and moral and political squalor. And the achievement, though, the real achievement, is that all of those people whom I've just named have produced or nurtured a new generation of young activists. Well, most of them now are mature, middle-aged people, but their children, our grandchildren, are continuing to do the work. And they're the ones that will carry it and push against the coalition, and they are the ones that have started already in confronting what I think is a really horrific, looming utterly, undesirable future. My other point as well is that with the new generation of activists, thinkers, school teachers, writers, we have an amazing, surging, glorious visual and creative arts sector. And I think that with the new writers, and certainly with the sculptors, with the painters, with the filmmakers, with people like Taika Waititi, Chelsea Winstanley, Mike Jonathan, Brett Baum, Lisa Rehana, we are seeing not just that hope springs eternal, that hope and a really brilliant future for our kids, for the uri, whakatupuranga, and for Aotearoa as a nation is something that we can make together. Even though I've got to say, Aotearoa as a nation, looking at Hobson's Choice, looking at Atlantis, looking at the coalition, Aotearoa as a nation is something that we must actively and energetically and passionately define for ourselves. We must not let other people determine what that future is. And that's where the challenge remains. And that's why I'm so proud of and so humbled by our kids, and particularly the ones that are surviving, that are flourishing, and that are carrying the kaupapa forward.
Ngā mihi. Thank you very much for your time today, and all the very best with the book. That is Ngā hui a te awe kōtuku. The book is Hine Toa, A Story of Bravery.